Hello and welcome to the Unnamed Automotive Podcast. My name is Sammy Hajj Assad, and with me, as always, is my good friend and fellow automotive journalist, Benjamin Hunting. Say hi to the people, Ben.
Greetings, corporeal and non-corporeal listeners.
Greetings to everyone. If this is the first time you're listening to our podcast, thank you for trying something new. I will reiterate, Ben and I are a pair of automotive journalists, but more importantly than that, we're really good friends. Isn't that right, Ben?
Friendship is important. I'll agree with that.
It makes the world go round, doesn't it?
It does a lot of things, Sammy. Friendship wears many masks.
Ben is a very established automotive writer, and you can find his work all over the internet. Ben, give some people, you know, some clues, like
very established makes it sound like I'm recording this from my library where I have many leather-bound books.
They're not leather bound. Some of them are pleather bound. Some of them use Sensitech.
Certainly none of them are human skin in any way. That is completely out of the question.
Only the forbidden library.
The forbidden library from which I do not record. because from which no sound might escape.
That's right.
You can find my work outside of the forbidden library at Motor Trend, Car and Driver, and Haggerty. Let's go with that.
And you can find my work at autotrader.ca, driving.ca, and Electric Autonomy Canada. Whew. Ben, we've got some cars to talk about this week, as That's usual.
Right. We didn't decide which one we were going to talk about first, though, I don't think.
I'm going to give you the go-ahead. I think you should start first, because we've talked about the subcompact crossover that you've driven in a different way in the past. We're going to talk about the 2024 Hyundai Kona, which I've driven the N-line version of, and I think you have too.
Yeah, and so the one I'm talking about has a battery, Sammy.
Well, I mean, I think they all have batteries, and but this one has a big old battery.
I keep calling
it a BOB.
BOB. Don't search for that online, kids. Okay. I keep calling it the Kona EV because I think at one point in its past it might have been called that, but it's called the Kona Electric. That's how it's named, and I need to train myself to stop using Kona EV everywhere.
Is electric all lowercase?
I do not participate
in the way that
they
describe that. Is that funny? Isn't that? I always love the branding exercise of automakers when they're like, oh, it's an electric car, so we need to say that part quietly.
I get it. Like, I understand branding, but when you're trying to use it in a practical sense, it just quickly becomes complicated, right?
Right.
Like,
right.
I'm starting a sentence, or do I have to whisper, as you just pointed out? But the Kona Electric is interesting because There are a few reasons. The first is it's the second generation version of the Kona, right? And in some ways, it's a conversion car because the original Kona Electric was the gas Kona with a battery and an electric motor, a single electric motor. But what they did this time, apparently what they're telling people they did this time, is when they redid the platform for both vehicles, they decided to go EV first. And I'm not sure exactly... This was definitely something that was important to them because they favored the placement of the battery, they favored the placement of the motors, and then they decided to put the power drivetrain, the gas power drivetrain in after. So it's kind of a conversion car. It's kind of not. The platform is the same as the platform from the old car, but it's bigger, it's longer. I think it's also wider. And there are numerous differences in terms of the details, but the most interesting thing overall about the Kona Electric is that it doesn't bring any new generation of electric drivetrain with it, Sammy.
Okay, so it's the same powertrain as before. That's both
yes
battery
and, no. Yes
and
no.
Motor? Okay,
yeah,
what do you mean by that then?
Well,
Why are you saying one thing and immediately changing your mind?
Because I said it was the details that were different, but the generalities are the same. Why this is intriguing for a Hyundai is we all know that on this show, we've talked repeatedly about how much we like the EGMP platform mm-hmm. that is available from vehicles like the IONIQ 5, the IONIQ 6, and on the Kia side, the EV6.
Okay.
It's really great. It's an 800 volt charging system. Theoretically, it can charge at 350 kilowatts. But regardless of, you know, the ideal perfect solution, it does charge very fast. It has decent amount of power, decent amount of range, and it's generally a great all-purpose drivetrain. The Kona EV does not have that drivetrain in it. Even though it's a new generation of the vehicle, they stuck with the 400-volt architecture that they had used on the previous car. The battery is 68.4 kilowatt hours, which is about 10 kilowatt hours less than what you would find on the long-range versions of the IONIQ 5 or the IONIQ 6.
Yeah.
And the electric motor, it's ostensibly the same as it was before, but they've detuned it. So it still has 201 horsepower, which I think is the same as the model it replaces.
Oh, right. Yes. It has less torque, right?
It has a lot less torque. On the torque side, 188 pound-feet is now standard. It used to have like 290-something, I think.
290. Yeah. It's lost like 100.
So the reason for that...
Hold on one second, Ben. I'm sure a lot of people might be listening to us and wondering, why are they talking about the powertrains of two different vehicles? It's not uncommon for automakers to share the powertrain among their portfolios. Yes. I mean, the gas Kona and the gas-powered Elantra, I think you can get the same powertrain in the two of them. You know, it makes sense that, you know, to make things a little bit easier or maybe cost-effective for the automaker, that they could use the same technology across their entire portfolio.
But another reason...
And we would have... And the precedent is there with the gas-powered vehicles that they could do that.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
We would expect the really, like, good powertrain or good electric technology that we've experienced in the Ioniq cars to also translate into the non-Ioniq vehicles, right?
Yeah, that's part of it. Another part of it, though, for me is this is a redesigned car, which you would think would give them the opportunity to go to a new technology, all the things that you just described, and take, you know, benefit from that sharing. And they very consciously decided not to do that. And it's an interesting choice, because if you look at another similarly sized, similarly powered vehicle, the Chevrolet Bolt.
GM, we always bring up the poor Chevy Bolt. Is this the EUV or the non-EUV?
It doesn't matter, because both of them were pulled from the market because GM decided it didn't want to continue with its older electric technology. It wanted to make all versions of the Bolt have the Ultium platform, which is their, you know, their version of the 800 volt. I don't know if it's 800 volt, but like the high charge rate, the high speed charging, high technology electric platform. So GM looked at its entry-level electric car and said, this isn't good enough. We don't want to continue with the old one. Hyundai looked at its entry-level electric car and said, this is fine. We're going to upgrade everything else about the vehicle, and we're only going to make tweaks to the existing powertrain. And I think that's a fascinating choice.
Why? Tell me more. I mean, it is. I agree. It is a fascinating choice.
Because when Chevrolet...
Do you think they just had parts lying around?
I think it's fascinating because when Chevrolet made this choice, they essentially ceded the entry-level electric market to whoever wanted it. They're gone. And they were a lot cheaper than the... I'm going to talk in Canadian pricing right now because that's the one I have most available to me. But the entry-level Bolt was like $8,000 cheaper than the entry-level Kona. So it was already a bargain. And now that car is gone. So there's no more pressure on Hyundai to make the Kona cheaper. They can just keep it at whatever price point they want. And the Bolt was very, very popular. Lots of people bought that. And so if you are someone whose neighbor had a Bolt and you were like impressed with the car, or you heard your neighbor say good things about it, and you go to a Chevy dealership, you can't get that car anymore. You can't even get like a legacy version. You're stuck with whatever inventory might still be left. So that's going to push you to another showroom. And it's strange that Chevrolet didn't continue selling the Bolt until Ultium was ready. And they're actually having this 1 or 2 year gap.
I mean, Ultium, we're still waiting to hear Ultium being really ready.
I mean, the Hummer EV has been out for a couple of years now, so I would say
How many of them needed an update like the Blazer and the Lyriq did too?
It's I'm not saying it's not problematic, but that would make the choice even stranger.
Right? You're right in the fact that when we've driven, and I think we're not the only ones, I think a lot of members of the media have driven the Bolt and come across really positive on that Chevy product, specifically because it combined really decent range with a really good price. And then now we don't have this vehicle. But things have happened to the Bolt since or during its lifespan. It got a disaster, like a PR disaster kind of happened to it in terms of stop sales and do not drive orders,
sure,
which I think are pretty serious.
But that's happened to so many different vehicles. And we focus on the EVs because everyone wants to focus on the EVs when something
bad happens. Well, they're new. They're very new. And
I mean, currently the Wrangler 4xe PHEV has the same thing on it right now, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. And I think, you know, not even non-battery powered vehicles like I remember the Colorado and Canyon had a stop sale recently. Like,
yeah, and I think also there were some Hyundai gas-powered vehicles that had a fire risk, and the Ford Escape had a fire risk for a large number of its models. And there was like an oil pipe inside the engine, a piece of the oil tubing that would break and dump oil onto the exhaust manifold. And anyway,
but the news took the Bolt stop sale and those potential fires or actual fires. And brought them front of mind to, I think, of a lot of EV, potential EV buyers or something like that. And I think its reputation suffered pretty drastically.
It's possible, but sales stayed strong. It's by far the most popular. I think it's the most popular EV that is not a Tesla, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, wow. That's pretty impressive.
The sales are really good because
considering a car is no longer in production for the past year or two.
Yeah, it hits that price. Last year hits that sweet spot of usable range, decent power, and a good price. So let's get back to the Kona.
Yep.
In the US, there are two different versions. There's a smaller 50 kilowatt hour or 48.6 kilowatt hour battery pack with a 200 mile range. We don't get that in Canada. We get the one I mentioned earlier that has a 260 mile range, which is about 405 kilometers or something like that, 420 kilometers. If you are wondering how much you have to pay for this vehicle, in Canada, it's like, I believe, $49,000 once you include shipping costs and preparation, all that stuff. In the States, because you can get the smaller battery, it's $34,000. But if you want the larger battery, which is what I would recommend, it's $38,000. And the top tier trim is like $42,000.
How much range does the small battery have again?
It's 200 miles.
That doesn't sound great.
No. But it's...
I mean, it's not great.
It's not terrible, though. It's not absolutely terrible. In any case, I don't recommend you get that version. But the problem with getting the larger version of the car, the larger battery version of the car, is suddenly you're paying very close to the same amount of money as you would for an Ioniq.
Okay.
In Canada...
Yeah.
The Ioniq...
That is a problem. Like, that's a real problem.
The starting price for the 5 and the 6 is, like, just under 58 grand, which means you're within $9,000 or so of the Kona EV. And if you buy the high trim level Kona Electric, that drops to like a $5,000 difference. And I can just tell you that there's more power, there's more space, there are more features, and much faster charging if you spend that extra $5,000 to get the Ioniq. This is where the whole Bolt thing comes into the conversation again, because it kind of looks like the Kona Electric is like the bargain EV from Hyundai, but it really isn't. It is still...
Yeah, I mean, in terms of features and functionality.
It is still a high-priced vehicle.
Yeah.
And it's not a bad
vehicle. No, sorry. I wanted to finish my thought there. In terms of features and functionality, its value is not... is not there. It's not a very good bang for your buck kind of car. Because, as you mentioned, the Ioniq, for just a little bit more, gets you more range, more space, more features. And that's worth it, right?
Yeah, and the price differential in the States is even smaller. I mentioned that the big battery electric, Kona Electric, is 38. The entry-level Ioniq 5 is 41.
Yeah.
You know, that's a really small gap. And in fact, the top-tier Kona Electric is more expensive than a base Ioniq 5. So who's buying, who's this car for, Sammy?
I don't know. This doesn't make any sense to anybody.
Like, if you can't afford the extra money, I get it. It's about a 15% difference. That's not nothing, right? And we're not even talking about incentives and stuff. This is before all of that comes into play. But those numbers will be the same for either vehicle. So, you know, if whatever you're subtracting, you still have this 15% difference. Another thing to take into account when you look at these two cars, the Kona Electric's a front-wheel drive car. The Ioniqs are both rear-wheel drive. The dynamics are better. I'm not saying they're not much faster because they're a lot heavier because of the larger battery and the larger size. They're within about a half second of each other, 0 to 60, when you're talking about the single-motor versions. But they do drive better. So you're getting class above performance and comfort, I think. I liked driving the Kona around. I got about 300 kilometers per charge, which is, you know, reasonable in very cold weather. It was hovering right around freezing. 300 kilometers is, I want to say, 200 miles. Is that right, Sammy?
That sounds fair. Yeah, that sounds about right.
And I'm charging at home on a level 2 charger, so I don't really care too much about the fast charging. But if I was on a road trip, the difference is huge. Like, it takes about 40 minutes to go from 10% to 80% on a DC fast charger for the Kona Electric. It's less than half that amount of time for the Ioniq. It's like It's like 17 minutes.
Yeah.
So all of this.
So that's one of the major deficiencies with this car that, you know, I think has a value, right?
I think all of these deficiencies come into play.
I think, you know, the performance is the straight line performance or the power difference between the two, because the Ioniq is a bigger car. It may not feel as responsive. But there's a
range difference too. Like you're looking at 50 more miles range in the Ioniq 5, and the Ioniq 6 is like much more than that. I think it's another 60 or something like that, because it's more aerodynamic. The Ioniq is just a better all-around vehicle. The Kona Electric is a vehicle I like if it was $9,000 cheaper in Canada and probably another $5,000 cheaper in the States. Although, again, the base model in the States is there. If you are just going to stick with that super entry-level model, it does make sense to buy it financially. If you don't really need the extra range, which is possible if you're mostly driving around town, it could make sense. I don't think that's a bad option. It has a lot less power, though. You're not just getting less range. It goes down from like 200 horsepower to 133 horsepower. That's almost 50%. So keep that in mind as well. It's a strange vehicle, which is too bad because I like it. Looks good. It's comfortable. It has cool features inside. Everything works. I didn't have any real problems with it. It's just positioned in a strange way.
The interesting thing is that, like, we know that Hyundai and Kia have a lot of synergy between the two brands. A lot of the technology is shared. The design is obviously different. But they have the same problem, I think, with the Niro EV and the EV6. There's a $3,000 difference between the two. And I think the EV6 is a far more fully featured and more spacious product. And it's just like, what is happening at this lower end? Is there an entry-level EV that makes sense, right?
I mean, there's the Leaf out there. There's the it's not. I think it has somewhat similar range, but I'm not as big a fan of that vehicle. I don't think it's as modern as the Kona. And the other similarly sized vehicles, like the BZ4X and the Solterra, are as expensive, if not a little bit more expensive, than the Kona Electric and the Niro EV. I'm not really sure what you would consider an entry-level electric at this point. Like, everything seems to be coalescing around this $35,000 to $40,000 mark in the US and the $50,000 mark in Canada.
Like, I'm finding the Mini, but the Mini, I think, has much less range.
I think it's like 100-something miles.
Yeah.
The current one, and the new one isn't here yet. I don't know how much range that one has. There's the Fiat EV, the Fiat 500 EV, which also has less range.
Yeah.
And these things, I think, are size related. Like, these are smaller platforms, so they can only put so much battery in them. It's a tough choice. I just really missed the Bolt. Like, I used to be able to tell people who wanted a cheap electric car, just go buy a Bolt and don't worry about it. And now I can't do that. And now I don't have
the ID4 super expensive? I can't remember the pricing on that thing.
I want to say it is. I want to say it's the same $35,000 to $40,000, which is, you know, it's not hyper expensive, but it's certainly not cheap when you look at what you're getting. I just don't have a go-to anymore.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest issue. Everything is just a smidgen under $40,000, and that's it, right? Like,
yeah.
ID4 at 38 sounds competitive to the
It's the same Kona. As the Kona Electric. It's the same price.
And it has 270, let me see, 275 miles of range. That sounds pretty decent.
Sure. I mean, that's good.
The entry-level model only has 209. Man, they keep doing this. They got to stop it with these.
So you're saying the entry-level model has the same range as the $34,000 small battery Kona.
Yeah.
And it's priced $5,000 more?
Yep.
Oh, see, again, I mean,
What are we doing? When do we get cheap EVs?
I want to end this segment because I feel like we've just been making the same points over and over because we're trapped in this like cycle of similar pricing.
Is it only EVs that are too expensive? Like,
no, at least cars are too expensive too, but at least I can say, hey, go buy a Trax, you know?
Yeah.
Or
yeah, that's true.
Or go buy a Kicks, and those cars are under 25 and they're good. There's nothing wrong with them. You won't be disappointed. You know, whereas with these electric cars, I think once you start spending $40,000, you have expectations.
Yeah.
At least I do. And Well, these cars are
especially
fine.
When you've driven another vehicle just like in that price range that delivers everything you want it to.
Sure.
Right? In the Ioniq
and
or
the,
other EVs.
The Ioniq is like, it's right there, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's everything else on the Hyundai lineup kind of pales in comparison when you're looking at EVs. So it suffers right. because it has great siblings. And it didn't have to be this way. They could have cut prices. They could have made it a loss leader. They could have made it the car that you buy, and then 5 years later, you buy an Ioniq. You know what I mean? Like, this could have been an entry-level rung on the ladder. Instead, it's mm-hmm. a rung you're going to skip. And I don't think that's a good position for an electric vehicle.
Yeah. It's an interesting concept because I've spoken to the Hyundai Canada CEO, and he believes that once somebody goes once somebody buys an electric car, they're usually pretty impressed with the performance, that they don't typically go back into a gas powered vehicle, which I'm not sure is true or not. That's just maybe his experience on the Hyundai level.
And also on the Hyundai level, it's important to consider that they don't have pickups, so mm-hmm. their customers are people who don't need what pickups sell.
Yeah.
So like they're not going to be like, if you had an electric vehicle and you wanted to tow.
Santa Cruz, if you want to call that a pickup.
True. That's true. But I guess I'm thinking of pickups that are more work oriented. Yeah, yeah. Like if you actually needed to tow something that was heavy, then you might have to leave the world of Hyundai completely.
Right. But in going with his mindset that an electric car buyer typically sticks with electric, it makes sense to make that car in a loss leader or something like that and get buyers into the electric vehicle range of Hyundai quicker and easier.
I'm sure that's what the Bolt was doing.
Yeah. But the Bolt didn't have much to grow out of, right?
Well, they had the whole Ultium plan to come after, right? Like you own a Bolt mm-hmm. and you buy a Blazer or something like that. But that failed for reasons that are unrelated to the Bolt.
Yeah.
So I mean, who could have foreseen that a vast sweeping plan enacted by an automaker might not have worked according to how it was laid out?
It is so curious, though, to see the automakers' EV strategies kind of like blooming. Like Ford only has these two EVs, as far as I understand. They have a Mach-E and a Lightning. Chevy has currently only two, if I'm not mistaken, Blazer and. And
there's Equinox.
Equinox, is that out yet?
It's really hard to tell.
Isn't that weird too? But at least they have the Hummer, if you want to call that. It's part of the GM portfolio.
And they have the Silverado,
the Lyric.
The Silverado is going to be on sale soon, I'm sure, because the prototypes are out all over the road. People have been driving them for quite a while. I think you can actually order them, and I'm not sure if customers are taking delivery. But there's also the Cadillac.
Lyric.
The Lyric. And the Celestiq, I believe, will be on sale this year.
And then Volkswagen has a couple of offerings. They have the ID4, and the media just drove the ID7. And eventually they're supposed to have the bus or the Buzz. Starting to see this like 1, 2, 3 kind of hit from the automakers in terms of their electric vehicle.
And of
offerings.
Course, BMW has a huge number of EVs that everyone is just conveniently.
Yeah, i4, i5, i7, iX. I think that's it.
And they all work and everything's fine. And just business as usual for BMW kicking ass when it comes to EVs, I guess.
But it's just interesting to look at some of these. I'm going to quickly segue into the automaker that I'll be talking about right now.
Okay. Do that, I just realized that Buzz is like bus.
Yes.
I didn't know that until
today.
I just got that.
Good one.
Also, there's a big problem with the Buzz. And do you know what it is?
Probably its weight and safety ratings or something.
It won't qualify for any federal incentives in the United States because of where it's manufactured.
Oh, right. Isn't that why they're going to build batteries in Canada?
I'm not sure because it's a real problem for the Buzz because of how expensive it's going to be to begin with. And it's the kind of vehicle where, you know how when a new enthusiast vehicle arrives, everyone who wants one buys one in the first year. And then in the second year,
no one buys it ever again.
Yeah, yeah, because it's so expensive, no one will be stepping up to the plate to do that. The need will be saturated.
They're taking their time to bring it here.
It kind of looks that way.
Yes. To get it right with the pricing, and especially if the manufacturing is part of the process, they're going to have to change that. The automaker that I'm going to talk about and the car that I'm going to talk about, there's not a lot of electrification in this automaker's lineup. It is Honda. Honda has a GM product that's been rebadged. I'm not going to talk about that. That's called the Prologue, I think it's called.
Wasn't there a Gran Turismo called Prologue?
Yeah, sure.
All right.
I'm going to be talking about because as you know, I've been driving a bunch of three-row vehicles because now I've become this sort of like dad. I have become a dad, but...
Yeah, thanks for correcting that. When your son listens to this in the future, he'll know that he was always in your thoughts.
And as a result, all of my assignments have been dad related, which is strange, but hey, at least I'm still getting paid here. So the vehicle I drove is the 2024 Honda Pilot, which is confusing because on the media site or the consumer site, it's listed as a 2025. So that's weird. Honda's in the future in this situation.
Yeah, you can't even buy the current model year, I don't think. I know I encountered the same thing earlier today when I was looking at the Pilot.
It's the Trail Sport model in particular. We've discussed the Trail Sport badging in the past or models in the past. I think particularly with the last generation Pilot and the Passport, in which they were just these kind of appearance packages, I guess is the best way to describe them, with funny tires.
Yeah, the Pilot actually... But now, the previous generation Pilot got stuff. The Passport didn't, but the previous generation Pilot, I think it had a different all-wheel drive system, if I'm not mistaken.
That's this current one, as far as I understand.
But I think the older one had it too.
Okay, cool. Well, now there goes everything I was going to talk about. Let's go right now.
No, keep going. I'm not saying they're exactly the same, but what I am saying is the Passport was just an appearance package, but the Pilot version of the Trail Sport had more going for it.
And I do think that the current generation model is a little bit more, has taken that a little bit further. They've got extra, it's got extra drive modes. It's got these all-terrain tires. It's a little bit more rugged. And all of these things kind of add up to a vehicle that's a little bit more interesting than before, because I think the outgoing Pilot was a dud. Like, it really was a boring vehicle. It was really big. It felt big. It felt slow. It was kind of expensive. And now we just have, it's been upgraded in so many ways.
Okay.
But so many of those characteristics still exist. I need to be clear here. It is not a fast product. It is got one of the worst transmissions I've ever felt on a modern vehicle. This thing hitches from a stop all the time. I don't know what's going on with this transmission, but it slams into gear around two or three, which is disappointing. The powertrain... The engine has been completely redesigned and contains the same amount of horsepower and torque as the outgoing model. So
when you can completely redesign something, yet the changes are only available from an engineering perspective.
Is that wild? Equipment and packaging is a little bit better than, let's say, the Highlander Hybrid that I talked about recently. I do think that this feels like a far more fully featured product, especially with... all the safety features that are included in these cars, and very little is not included. I think in terms of non-standard safety features, it doesn't have front and rear parking sensors, and it doesn't have a low-speed braking system, like an automatic emergency braking.
So it only brakes at high rates of speeds?
Yeah, apparently. No, those features are included on everything but the base model. But it has everything else. It has like a rear cross traffic alert. It has blind spot monitoring. It has automatic high beams. It has adaptive cruise control that does stop. Lane keeping, all that stuff. So I'm happy with all of those doodads. It has rear sunshades, which I really like. Our model has rear heated seats, rear climate control. It has just about everything. I'm loving the features, but this isn't a cheap car. It starts at $49,000 for the Trail Sport, which includes all-wheel drive. So, but yeah,
I want to touch back on we were talking about the Pilot, the 2025 model that you're driving. It's not a refresh, is it?
No, nothing has really changed from the new model that came last year.
Okay, so looking on the previous versions of the Pilot. It's really confusing to figure out what had what. I'm looking at the Trail Sport for 2022, and it got a lifted suspension, which is like 0.6 inches of extra ground clearance, and it had tires and 18-inch wheels. And then if you look at the 2023 version, which is, I think, the redesign, if I'm not mistaken, then it got a torque vectoring differential,
Yeah.
Terrain contact all-terrain tires, and I'm not sure if it got anything else.
It does have an inch more ground clearance as compared to the other models, but okay, I don't think that means that it has... That's 8.3 inches. Is that equivalent to what it used to have?
It's less than a stock Subaru Forester.
Yeah, which is
8.7. Oh, my God. But yeah, so I just want to say, sorry, I was confused earlier when I was thinking about... Because I know the Passport was mostly appearance, and I think... For a while, the Pilot was a mixture of appearance and technology, but it looks like it was mostly tires and suspension. So,
yeah,
the problem when you're dealing with these faux off-road trims is it can be tough to figure out like what if your ground clearance is because of suspension or if it's because you have knobbier tread on the tires. You know, like there's a whole bunch of stuff that's in the mix. Sorry to interrupt you with that. I just want to.
I think you're right. I think this does have knobbier tires. It does come with the all-terrain tires, and that adds a lot more to it.
Is there anything about the Trail Sport package that you feel compromises regular driving?
Well, I mean, those tires are going to be loud, and the fuel efficiency on this vehicle is not very good.
Yeah, I think it's like 1 mile per gallon less than the standard one, right off the bat.
Yeah. As it stands, it gets 20 miles per gallon combined, which is awful.
Oh, that's really not great. And this is from the completely redesigned engine that's exactly the same.
Yes. And
we forgot something.
To make things worse, that's just the ratings for fuel economy. I have not seen that kind of fuel consumption yet. I'm getting about 19.
You got a heavy foot.
I don't know about that, but yeah, it just doesn't feel... This car looks better, and like I said, it's better packaged, but little bits of it are feeling awful. Like I said, that powertrain, something's not meshing well with it, and it also feels huge. Like, this feels big. This is a problem because, obviously, three-row vehicles have been getting bigger, so much so that Toyota had to make a whole new product just to compete in this class again. I think kind of, but there were also the Hyundai Palisade and the Kia Telluride, which are really popular. They don't feel as big as this. Okay. Which is crazy to me. When you drive those don't feel like you're driving a school bus and you need a second, like a different license for it, which is what I get when I'm driving this Pilot at times.
So it's I guess that's why they made the Passport, right? Like, they wanted that smaller version. I just double checked on the Passport Trail Sport, and it is just bumpers and a new hood and a blocky rear grill. There's like, it has exactly the same ground clearance as any other Passport in the system.
Yeah. So I'm struggling with that, with this, you know, with this feeling, because like I said, the outgoing generation of Pilot suffered in a couple of key ways. It was particularly boring. It was boring to drive, and it was boring to look at. And it felt kind of expensive for what it was. This one has better packaging, and it looks better, but it's awful. It's not boring to drive. It's awful. Like, this transmission really is... It bothers me every single time I come to a stop sign or take off from a stoplight, and it's just really not good. I don't know what's going on with this thing.
Now, Honda has historically had problems with automatic transmissions.
Is that true? Talk to me.
Think about, well, if
this
you
is,
look
this
at
the, is a 10-speed.
The Odyssey from the 2000s into the early 20-teens was a nightmare. And any other vehicle from Honda that had that same transmission, I know people personally who had two or three warranty replacements. And that's crazy.
It's wild. It's really an unfortunate situation to be in.
And this one is necessarily unreliable, but it doesn't surprise me to hear that a heavy, large Honda with a newish transmission is having difficulty.
Yes. So this is a 10-speed auto. And the engine, it has a 3.5-liter V6 that puts out 285 horsepower and 262 pound-feet of torque. This is important to talk about because other vehicles in its class have swapped to turbocharged engines, be it a turbocharged 6 like the CX-90 or a turbocharged 4 like the Highlander or Subaru Ascent.
Do you really think the CX-90 is in the same class as the Pilot?
I think it would love to be. I mean, fair I enough. Think in fair terms enough. Of its sales, it would love to be.
Objection sustained.
I think the CX-90 got more expensive and bigger and fancier. It has all these features, right?
Yeah. We've beaten that one, though, to death, I think.
Yes. And then this thing has a naturally aspirated V6. Same with the Korean twins that we talked about before, the Telluride and the Palisade. But those just feel a little bit more refined right now, which is crazy.
Because they didn't feel refined when they first came out.
Yeah. And so their powertrain was their weakest part, I think.
Only in comparison to Honda do these engines feel refined.
I used to complain. You know what? It's true. I used to complain about that V6 as being the weak point in the entire product. And I meant that in a complimentary way, kind of being that everything else was so good that the powertrain was just normal, average.
I kind of feel like Hyundai is a bit stuck there because they have some really good turbocharged drivetrains and Genesis products, mm-hmm. but those are all longitudinal engines, right? That drive the rear wheels. And plus, they need that differentiation because the Palisade is a pretty good vehicle. And if you suddenly give the Palisade like 400 horsepower, you are going to have difficulty selling Genesis models. So
it's going to be so good. That's going to be such a good car. A Kia, look, they have the Kia Telluride GT or something will kill it. That's going to be so good if that exists.
So I'm not sure in the portfolio, like right now, what you would put that was turbocharged under the hood of the Palisade or the Telluride, because I wouldn't want a turbo 2-liter 4. And right. I don't think like they have that in the Stinger, right? Is it a 2-liter in the Stinger?
Yeah.
I don't think that's necessarily the solution. And again, packaging, who knows how that fits, because it's right. longitudinal to horizontal again. So they're kind of stuck.
But I'm bringing up those turbo fours, those turbocharged motors, because they feel way more responsive than this naturally aspirated 6. This just might be the transmission or this new engine kind of showcasing its weaknesses. But you know, I drove that Highlander hybrid and I was like, that thing, I'm getting out of that. And I'm typically kind of low on the Highlander, but that feels like a more refined product than this Honda and Pilot, which is brand new.
The turbo engines that are in like the Accord or the Civic, and you don't...
Which are fine.
They're fine. Like, they work well. So Honda obviously can do it. It's strange to me that they put so much energy...
I think actually the Pathfinder's powertrain is better than this, which is...
Doesn't it have a CVT?
No, they've changed it to a 9-speed now.
So the Passport actually has a 9-speed and not a 10-speed, which I think is interesting. It is weird. Do you remember?
But that's because it's on the last-gen tech, last-gen platform and everything.
Do you remember when you could get an Odyssey that had like a 9-speed or a 10-speed? I think it was like different, like Elite and Elite Touring, I think had different transmissions in them.
Wow. It sounds at that point they were just throwing things at the wall to see what sticks.
Imagine if you were a service manager at a Honda dealership and they're like, get this. It's the same van, but you'll never know what the transmission is until they bring it in. So you're going to have to stock all these parts just in case someone brings in a 10-speed. I think it was a 9 to a 10. It might have been an 8 to a 9. I just know there was like that one extra gear if you wanted to pay more for it. But from what you're saying, perhaps don't do that.
So what I'm saying is that there are some better choices in this class. I'm sorry to say that I sound like a broken record, but those two Korean products still sit at the top of the segment, I think, for me. And that new Grand Highlander is quite good if you value space.
And you can go in a totally different direction and get something like an Explorer that mm-hmm. will let you tow, mm-hmm. has similar amounts of interior space. You can get a performance version. It's like you're in the ballpark, but you're hitting to a different field. You can also get the Grand Cherokee L, which I think is similar to the Expedition in terms of idea.
I also really like, I recently drove an Atlas, and I used to really be low on the Atlas, but they've really refreshed it like recently. They've given it a pretty thorough refresh. The only issue is, they still don't have the right illumination settings inside it, so that's still a bother. Like,
yeah, we had a comparison episode. If you want to hear that, go back a couple episodes, 2 or 3, and Sammy compares the Atlas to the Ascent, and he gets in detail about some of the infotainment and UI faux pas there inside the Volkswagen.
But that's all they're trying to say is that like Honda can deliver a new product, but it can still have some of the same issues that kind of plagued it in the past, I think.
That's disappointing.
It is. It was. And I drove it on the first drive about a year ago, and I came across, you know, I really liked the size it presented and the styling, but after driving it for much more, I can say that the powertrain is still a weak spot, and the fuel efficiency in particular was really rough.
So anything you want to wrap up with before we move on to a listener question?
Yeah, let's wrap up to this. No, I'm done. Let's go to this listener question. I love this question.
All right. We have Zubila wrote in to ask us a question about a family vehicle. And this is, honestly, this was not an easy question in a lot of ways, because they are looking at a Tesla Model Y or a Toyota Sienna all-wheel drive XLE.
That's one heck of a... Those are two very different vehicles.
But the it's a logical question in the sense that they need a family vehicle. They are one adult and two children, and both of the kids are under the age of 10. So that means, you know, something like a Model Y, there's enough space to keep the have the kids, give the kids enough space, and have all their gear with them. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if you're looking at wanting, you know, class above in terms of space, the Sienna gives you that extra row in the back. And they're saying they used to have an Odyssey.
Yeah.
And they used all the seats when they had visitors over. But it's going to be less common in the future. Their driving needs are changing. So that's why the Model Y has entered in the picture. The things that are important are features like, you know, nice to have stuff like Bluetooth, rear view camera, heated seats, USB power, power liftgate, rear heating. The looks aren't as important. Maybe they want a heated steering wheel, extra cameras, a vacuum, you know, like the gimmicky stuff.
Yeah.
The stuff that's also useful, like the refrigerator inside the vehicle. And the all-wheel drive is a consideration because they live, like me, they live in a mountainous area.
Right.
So I totally get it. It's strange. So where I'm recording this today, and I live about 70 miles from my parents. And they do not have we just got hit with a crazy amount of snow overnight. And they have the same temperatures, but they did not get the same snow that we did. And it's just because the elevation is higher here, this is just something that we have to take into account. And it can be unpredictable. So I don't always know what I'm going to encounter out on the road. So ground clearance is another consideration, Sammy, because they have a Camry, and they had the Odyssey, and it was an annoyance. It was occasionally a problem. So again, the Sienna rides a little higher when it's an all-wheel drive form. The Model Y also rides a little higher. Sammy, what's your take on comparing these two vehicles for Zubila's particular use case?
That's a really tough comparison. I mentioned to you that, you know, I mentioned to you before the podcast that Teslas are a difficult nut to crack. They don't have a media program. They seem to particularly dip the media. And don't send out press loans.
So a lot of our experience with them comes from talking to owners.
Yeah, it comes from anecdotal evidence, from talking to people or looking at research or data. And in my experience, products like the 3 and the Y and the X have had a pretty rough reputation in terms of reliability and quality.
Yes. I recently worked on a piece where I was researching reliability for specifically the 3, which I believe the Y is the SUV version of the 3, correct?
Yeah.
Same platform. They have a long record of suspension failures, especially front suspension and steering. And it's not related to anything other than manufacturing defects and problems with parts suppliers. So some people were having this issue, even if they had just bought the vehicle like a couple of months beforehand. For some people, it took longer to show up. But when they would get to the dealership, or not the dealership, whatever service center that they have available to them, and this is something I think Sammy wants to talk about later, they were told that even if they were, what would happen is the service managers would try to blame owners, and they would say, oh, you hit a curb or you hit a pothole. This isn't, you know, something that we're responsible for. But when they were pushed, they would replace it, only to kind of give them the caveat that this is going to happen to you again. We don't have this problem fixed on our own side.
I've also been told that some of their fixes would be done free of charge if they signed an NDA.
Yeah, that's not a great look for an automaker.
That's not a good look.
But Sammy, you were concerned with where are you even going to get this vehicle fixed?
Right, yeah. I always think this is a major concern in terms of serviceability, customer service. And it's a shame because I think technology-wise, there's a lot to appreciate with the Teslas. They have big batteries, they have plenty of range, or so they claim, and they have pretty good powertrains. But the rest of the product, like we said, reliability and quality control is not quite there. The interiors are really, like, they're not special. Like, they don't feel like... These are $40,000 cars, man. Like,
they are getting better, but okay. I have to agree with you. They don't feel as special as they could. Zabila also brings up that the sliding doors on the van are a main attraction. It is way, 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 way easier to load kids into sliding doors, to load almost
anything. And get into
anything.
The third row.
Yeah.
And to get in the third row. Yeah.
And like they mentioned, if you're in a parking lot, especially, you know, managing kids behind a door, you don't want to. I remember my parents having pickup trucks where the doors did the whole suicide door thing, where they had the rear hinge at the back and the front hinge on the front, and you would create this situation where you would be boxed in and you, in a parking lot, and you couldn't get out. And like, you don't want a kid to get into that, right? So obviously not a problem with the Y, you just have the standard doors, but it is definitely way easier. A minivan is the most practical shape for utility that has ever been devised. It is a box that has three enormous entry points, one on each side and then one at the back. You can, between those, get almost anything inside the vehicle easily.
So, I mean, I guess what we're saying here is that the minivan is the better choice, but I think you had an issue with the Sienna in particular.
So, I would choose the minivan over the Model Y if I wanted a practical vehicle, if I wanted something, like Sammy said, that is well-built, has a good warranty and a good reputation. But the Sienna has a couple of asterisks for me. The hybrid drivetrain, which I believe is standard across all of the models right now, It is a bit buzzy. It's not super smooth. And that might be an annoyance. I would recommend driving it to see how you feel about it. I have friends who personally have this model vehicle. They like a lot of things about it, but for them, the biggest issue has been the second row of seats is not removable anymore. And what I mean by not removable is, sure, if you went in there with like a screwdriver and some a socket set, you can get them out. But almost every other minivan has a clip in and out system where you can just lift the seats out and remove them. And as a result, it can limit some of the types of cargo that you carry. And surprisingly, this has been an irritant to some of my friends who are like, you know, I could have gotten something inside of it if I was just able to get these seats out. So that's something to consider. It might not apply to your particular situation. It might not be an issue, but something to think about. The third thing about the Sienna, though, is that it is by far the smallest minivan inside compared to any other minivan. And You'll notice this going from the Odyssey to the Sienna. There's 100 cubic feet of cargo space available behind the front seats in the Sienna. That's largely because you can't remove the seats in the second row, so you're putting stuff on top of them. But it's also just smaller inside. That is like 50 cubic feet less than your Odyssey, like between 40 and 50. It's a huge amount.
That's a huge drop, yeah.
So definitely check that out. Definitely A/B that with the Odyssey that you're driving now to make sure that it's a downgrade that you can accept. Those would be my three concerns. Other than that, I am pro minivan on this.
Now, would you recommend that? So would you recommend then a new Odyssey over this or another minivan?
Yeah, because Zabila says that ground clearance has been a hassle with the Odyssey. They have a 2015 or have had a 2015. That's not something that's going to change with the new model. You're going to be dealing with the same thing. And you can't get all-wheel drive. And in the mountains, if you need that security, your options are limited. I believe you can get an all-wheel drive version of the Chrysler Pacifica, which is a van I really like. And I think the plug-in is amazing, maybe out of the price range of what we're talking about here, because I'm not sure what kind of credits it qualifies for, and it can get quite pricey. But the other issue is I don't know if I can recommend long-term the quality of a Pacifica, because Zabila wants to keep this vehicle for 10 to 20 years.
This is so tough because I agree with you. I think the Pacifica and that plug-in version is pretty good. But we only get these cars for a week at a time, and they're generally pretty decent during that week. But I've heard the same thing that you've said. Long-term reliability on these things have not ranked very highly. Yeah. And it might not be something as serious as like a powertrain issue, but it might just be something really annoying like a glitchy infotainment system or something like that.
So all of this, I mean, I realize we've kind of, you know, we've talked a lot about this, but I think Sienna all-wheel drive XLE is the way to go here. And for those of you who are listening who are thinking, who keeps a car 10 to 20 years? I've had my CTS-V for 15 years now. and I'm never getting rid of it. So I totally understand this mindset. This is how I think too. When I look at, there are some cars, when I purchase them, I realize they're not going to stay with me for very long, but there are others that are going to be there for the long term. And when I do make that long-term purchase, I keep that in mind in terms of what it's going to cost me to repair, how complex the vehicle is, and how easily I can get parts. And in those contexts, I think the Sienna is the clear winner.
All right. I agree. I think that's perfect. I especially like the fuel efficiency. I've become very sensitive to that recently, and I think that this is great. Like,
I mean, the fuel efficiency of the Model Y is infinite, right?
So that's true. That's true. Anything else you want to talk about this week?
I think that's it for me. If you want to ask us a question, or if you want to criticize something Sammy has said specifically, you can reach out to us in a bunch of ways. The easiest way is to go to unnamedautomotivepodcast.com and use our contact form. You fill that out, you click submit, and it gets sent to our inbox. Or you can find us on social media. Sammy is on the cesspool, now known as X, where he is at Sammy_ha, like you're laughing. I am on the friendlier confines of Instagram, where everyone just shares images and has a good time. You can find me at Hunting Benjamin, or email me the old-fashioned way, benjamin@benjaminhunting.com.
Additionally, you can go to our website, unnamedautomotivepodcast.com. You can see all of our previous episodes and photos of the cars we've been driving, as well as links to the stories that we've written about them. And you should also subscribe to our podcast. You can do that by going to any podcasting client, and
just search on Unnamed Automotive Podcast.
Yeah,
there. And I think that's a comment, a review, a star rating, or share it with your friends. All that stuff is great. We really love it when you do that. Sammy, I also love it when you tell me what you're going to be driving next week.
I'm not going to do it this time. I like to keep you waiting.
What? No.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
That's my tease.
That's a total.
What are you driving?
That's a total. I was going to tell you, but now I feel kind of dumb.
Yeah, take that.
I'm going to be driving the Volvo V60 Polestar wagon, which is cool. Not just a plug-in hybrid, but a crazy fast plug-in hybrid.
No, seriously, I don't know what I'm driving next week.
Wow. All right. If only I could live on the edge like you, just moment to moment, just me, my partner, my son, and the world against us.
Yeah, that's how it feels sometimes. Thank you for everyone for listening. We'll see you next week.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.